The baby making years are hard. I'm Dr. Sterling, and I'm here to help. Welcome to the Ask Dr. Sterling podcast.
This content is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or qualified health provider with any medical questions you may have.
All right, my friends, we have an episode all about nausea and vomiting in pregnancy today, which may seem like who wants to talk about it? It's bad enough to experience it, but there's so many questions. We actually asked this question in our broadcast channel on Instagram, and we were flooded with so many questions and so many of, you know, similar questions that are actually really easy to answer that we thought, hey, let's just do an episode. It's an issue that affects over 90% of people in pregnancy. So let's talk about it. Let's get into it. And Claire, you have some really great questions from the broadcast channel for me. And I actually, before this episode, I know a lot about nausea and vomiting, but I thought, hey, let's check up and let's read some more research and some really cool stuff that's come about in the last year or so in terms of our advancements in understanding nausea and vomiting in pregnancy. So I'm excited to share lots of stuff with y'all.
I was blown away by the amount of questions we received in the broadcast channel. They came flooding in. Many obviously were touching on the same theme. So really excited to dive in here. But before we do, I want you to share real quick, because not everyone knows your experience in pregnancy. Oh.
I feel like I talk about it so much that how could any, but you're right.
Let's just remind our listeners here.
Let's just remind. Okay. So I have really difficult pregnancies, and one of the main reasons why I have such difficult pregnancies is because of really severe nausea. I have had a surgery on my stomach. It's called for those of you who care, a Nissen fund application. So I cannot actually vomit, which saved me from the diagnosis of hyperemesis because I'm not able to lose food, water, et cetera. Still severe nausea. There's criteria, and we can talk about that. Lots of dry heaving. So anyway, the experience was so overwhelming physically, emotionally, socially. I mean, it impacted every part of my existence was impacted by nausea in pregnancy that it's one of the things that really ended up with me being here talking to you because I felt so unsupported by the standard prenatal care system. I felt really misunderstood by all the people who were just like, isn't this just the best time of your life? And I'm like, what? I know that this is a really common symptom. My patients talk to me about it all the time. Why is everybody out here still pretending like pregnancy is this blissful journey? So anyway, yeah, it's a big reason why I'm here and a topic that is near and dear to my heart.
Perfect. So let's start with the basics here and excited to hear what the data tells us now, if we've studied this anymore, but why do some have it and some don't? And there is a range. And we're talking people who don't feel an ounce of nausea during pregnancy all the way to hyperemesis.
Yeah. So basically, the vast majority of pregnant women are going to experience some nausea and vomiting. So it's affecting 90% of people. However, a lot of those people are going to be in the mild to moderate. Okay. About somewhere between 6 and 10% are in the severe range. And then even smaller percentage of that develop what we call hyperemesis gravidarum. Now, hyperemesis is a severe form of nausea and vomiting of pregnancy that results in weight loss. There are people who will argue about how much weight you have to lose. The most kind of common is 5% or more of your pre-pregnancy weight. So if you're like 150 pounds, if you lose 7.5 pounds, that would qualify you. We know that we underdiagnose hyperemesis. And because a lot of people think it's normal, and you know, to some degree it is normal to have some nausea and vomiting of pregnancy, unfortunately, sometimes we're intervening too late. And we could be preventing more people from having hyperemesis. But, you know, there's a stigma to taking medications in pregnancy, which I know we're going to touch on, you know, risks and benefits of medication in pregnancy. There's a stigma. And so, unfortunately, this is an underdiagnosed and undertreated condition in pregnancy, and it leads to significant, I want to use the word morbidity, but got to reel back the doctor terms, but it leads to significant impact on people's health, both for the person who's carrying the pregnancy and the fetus. So we talked about the fact that most people are going to experience some nausea. Some people really know nausea, and that's fantastic. They're in that 10% of people, which 10% is a big, that's a huge amount of people. Okay. Because there's, 3 million births in the United States alone. So that's a lot of people, but it's still a minority. And the nausea and vomiting of pregnancy is multifactorial. Okay. There's not one cause to it. There's different hormones that are involved. The hormone that we all know of that we think has a big role to play, but again, not the only hormone that's playing a role is the actual pregnancy hormone, beta HCG. We see this because we know that it peaks in the first trimester when symptoms typically peak. The symptoms of nausea, vomiting, pregnancy peak around 9 weeks, and that's around the time that the pregnancy hormone is peaking, and then it starts to plateau around 10 weeks, which is sometimes we see people experience not a worsening of their symptoms. So it's a deceleration of their symptoms, a plateauing of their symptoms. So beta HCG does play a role, but it's clear that it's not the only player here. The interesting thing is that we know that people who are sensitive to estrogen-containing medications like birth control, we know that they're more likely to experience nausea, vomiting, and pregnancy, but estrogen doesn't peak until the third trimester. And for most people, the nausea and vomiting has resolved by then. So estrogen plays a role, maybe your sensitivity to estrogen plays a role, but it's not the only thing. And we know that progesterone probably plays a role because progesterone is a smooth muscle relaxer. Okay. It's a progestation hormone because it's going to stop your uterus, which is smooth muscle, from cramping. Normally, when you put something foreign is in the uterus, it doesn't like it and it starts cramping. So progesterone relaxes the smooth muscle in your uterus. It's also going to relax the smooth muscle in your gastrointestinal system. So it's going to slow down that transit. So your stomach oftentimes will take it empties more slowly. Other parts of your gastrointestinal tract are moving more slowly. So we know that that probably plays a role too. However, before we really started doing more, having the capability and doing more in-depth research into the different hormones and proteins produced by the placenta, we thought that, okay, maybe there's some sensitivity to these different hormones, even though the hormones themselves, and that may still be the case, but there's two proteins. One of them's a hormone and one of them is an insulin-like growth factor binding protein. There's these two proteins that are produced by the placenta that we think are more closely related to the actual development of nausea and vomiting and severe nausea and vomiting in pregnancy. So, for those of you who like to nerd out on this stuff, one of them is GDF15. So that's growth differentiation factor 15. And the interesting thing about this is, so we know that the placenta produces this, and we know that high levels are associated with anorexia, meaning not wanting to eat, okay? We think of anorexia nervosa as like a disordered eating disorder, but anorexia is something that people with other medical conditions like cancer also experience. So we think that GD15 has been implicated in the suppression of appetite in cancer patients. So we see it's higher in cancer patients, and it's also higher in people who experience severe nausea and vomiting in pregnancy. Interestingly, we've long known that people who smoke before pregnancy and, in pregnancy have lower rates of nausea and vomiting. We didn't really understand why we saw that. I do not advise this as something to,
not a preventative
as a
measure.
As a measure to take as a pressure, but I understand people who have hyperemesis, man, you might be tempted because it's so awful, but nicotine and smoking upregulates GDF15.
Interesting.
So what we think is that people who smoke may have just this prolonged exposure to higher levels, and so they're more accustomed to it. So when it comes to pregnancy, that isn't impacting them as much because their body has developed a, you know, quote unquote tolerance to it. It's just more used to that. So that's interesting. That's produced by the placenta, which the placenta, the creation of the placenta, that's under baby's DNA. People who have hyperemesis or severe nausea, vomiting, their family are more likely to experience it. It seems to come from the maternal side. It's not really, the paternal genes don't seem to be implicated. It's if your mother-in-law had severe hyperemesis, we're not necessarily seeing that impact you. Whereas something like preeclampsia, that could actually add your risk of preeclampsia. So that's how complex this stuff is.
Yeah.
And then the other one is IGF BP7. Okay. Also, this is a protein. Both of these proteins are involved in placentation, so helping the placenta to form. So that may be part of the reason why we see people who have high levels of GDF15 and of IGF-BP7, they have a lower risk of miscarriage, and they also have higher rates of nausea and vomiting of pregnancy.
Okay.
Really, really interesting stuff. So, you know, that's a long explanation, but I just,
no,
you know,
we love that. Yeah. That's what I kept seeing in the theme of the questions is people want to know why.
It's not your fault.
Exactly. Yes, I think even though you're saying a bunch of medical terms and a bunch of random protein names,
yeah,
being able to say there is a reason I feel so shitty.
Yeah. You're not making it up.
It means something. And I had a friend with hyperemesis, her first pregnancy, and then got pregnant with twins. Two placentas this time. And
oh, girl,
it was debilitating. Yeah. I mean, yeah. so brutal. And I've heard stories.
I mean, it can be life-threatening. This is what we're talking about. It can be life-threatening. Hospitalization, having to be on nutrition that goes through, in some cases, we can't even do tube feeds. We have to do something called TPN, where we actually put nutrition into your veins. Because it's so severe. Listen, the point of this is, I think one of the things, and this is still out there in the world, we do see that people who have a history of anxiety and depression have higher rates of nausea and vomiting. And so there is this like thing out there, and some physicians, especially those who are not keeping up and aren't aware of the evolving research on this, still think that there's an element of something we call like a somatization disorder, where it's really a mental health issue, but this person is kind of like
you're getting
physical symptoms.
Up, exactly. Essentially, that so sort of phrasing.
What I want to say about that is, what I think is more likely is that people who have these sensitivities to, you know, we see that people who suffer from migraines are more likely to have nausea, vomiting. We see that people who have motion sickness are more likely to experience nausea, vomiting. I think that if you are someone who has kind of a sensitive system, right? Like you have anxiety or depression, maybe part of that is because you have this physical sensitivity to the world and life, right? I mean, I experienced my first, I haven't ever had depression outside of pregnancy. And I think we're understanding that what's happening in the body, what's happening in the gut, what's happening, all of it is related to mental health. So mental health, physical health, it's the same thing. It's an old way of thinking that, oh, just because we see people who have depression or anxiety, they are more likely to experience a severe nausea, vomiting, that means that somehow it's their fault or it's in their head. If you're hearing that message from someone, I want to say that's a them problem. They're not up on their literature. They're not up on their learning. They're wrong. They're just wrong.
That's huge. And I know that's huge for people who are currently suffering with it. And so that's a great explanation of there's so many factors. Obviously, it sounds like we're still learning and gathering the info for it.
Oh, yeah.
Because we know women's struggles and their experiences tend to be lower on the totem pole for research.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I guess this makes sense for everything you listed to answer the question of how can it be worse in a single person's experience from one pregnancy to another?
Oh, yeah. Well, placenta. Your placenta is different.
So it's the baby's DNA.
And it could be baby's DNA, but it could be other factors that with the development of the placenta. Okay, because we know that when the hormone and the protein that are implicated in this, they're involved in placentation. They're involved in the development of the placenta. It's a chicken or the egg situation, you know, and we don't know exactly, okay, why is it higher in some pregnancies than others? It could be a genetic issue with the baby. It could be the exact timing of when implantation occurred, like what day. It could be the exact location of where implantation. There's so many things that could be implicated in it. But yeah, some people can have a pregnancy where they have very minimal nausea, vomiting, and then the next one they have hyperemesis.
That's so crazy. So yeah. Knowing that and knowing all the factors and knowing something like smoking was linked to less nausea, is there any healthy habits that we have control over that can prevent, reduce your risk, anything people can do ahead of time to manage?
Okay. So we see that people who are taking a prenatal vitamin for 3 months or more before pregnancy have a lower risk of nausea, vomiting, pregnancy. Now, I want to say that that's very unlikely to make a significant impact for somebody who had hyperemesis. It's probably not going to prevent hyperemesis. What we think it may be is that we do see deficiencies in like vitamin B6. That is part of the cause for some people. So I think what we're seeing here in the data is that there are some people who will benefit from taking a high quality prenatal vitamin months before they get pregnant. Okay. What we look at when we have somebody who's experienced, you know, moderate to severe nausea, vomiting, a pregnancy in a prior pregnancy, has had hyperemesis, or maybe there's somebody who's, you know, gets really a lot of nausea with birth control, or they have migraines and motion sickness, and we're just a little bit worried about, you know, the degree of their symptoms. So one of the things that we will do is, of course, start them on a high quality prenatal vitamin. And then for somebody who has had hyperemesis before, debilitating nausea, vomiting, we need to look at kind of the whole system of support that they have. And this is something that I talk to people a lot inside Sterling Parents about, because as you can imagine, a lot of people who've had, you know, really difficult pregnancies before come into Sterling Parents, they often come in before they are pregnant. And we are thinking, okay, what are all of the things we can do? So the things that I talk about with members of Sterling Parents who need this support is, let's try to reduce the amount of suffering that is associated with the nausea and vomiting. Okay. Addressing the nausea and vomiting, that is kind of a separate issue. A lot of that we can't really start doing until you're pregnant. So we can't start medication. We can start some medication once you get pregnant, but we're not really starting medication pre-pregnancy. But what we can do is look at the different sources of suffering when you have nausea, vomiting. So that is being able to take care of all of the other stuff in your life: laundry, dishes, preparing food, kids, work, and isolation and social stuff. Members of Sterling Parents, I'll walk them through, okay, talk to me about what was the isolation and the loneliness like for you when you had hyperemesis or nausea, vomiting. And some people are like, you know what? I had a really great support system that wasn't so much of an issue. And we're like, cool, moving on. But, you know, for someone like me, that was a big part of the suffering that I experienced because of this condition. So going into another pregnancy, it is talking to the people in your life about this reality and asking for help. I'm going to start trying to conceive again. I'm really nervous about feeling that, in being in that dark, lonely place again. Will you come over and watch movies with me when I'm your friends, your family? They love to hear it. They love to hear it. It's looking at work too. Like, okay, what's going on with work? Am I in the right job? Right? Am I in the right job to go through this right now? You know, people who have really toxic bosses and really toxic work situations, sometimes this can be the impetus to be like, you know what? It's time. I love the story of someone leaving a toxic job situation, you know, before they get pregnant. So anyway, this is just to say it's really multifactorial. So pre-pregnancy, we get your nutrition, we make sure you don't have any vitamin deficiencies that could contribute to that. And we look at the whole support system, all of the different levels of suffering that happen with nausea, vomiting. And then once you become pregnant, you make sure that, you know, everybody's on board. This is the algorithm. We're going to start with this medication. Oftentimes we'll start vitamin B6, even sometimes the prescription form of doxylamine and vitamin B6. We will just start that when they get pregnant.
So most of the questions we received in the broadcast channel were medication-based.
Yeah,
and I think a huge reason people are so confused and have so many questions is the mixed messages they get, whether it's online or even from their providers.
I know.
And this has been one of your biggest things inside Sterling Parents.
Yeah.
Where do you start when breaching that conversation when someone is so, so miserable?
Yeah.
And they are hesitant or have been told not to use medication to help.
Oh my gosh. I feel like this episode needs to go out to my colleagues, a lot of my colleagues who have really freaked people out on some of these medications. Okay. So that there's a very clear algorithm that we use for treating nausea and vomiting of pregnancy. In general, we are prescribing too few medications for this. And we aren't accelerating, like we aren't moving people through the algorithm at a fast enough pace. We should be giving medications about a week. Okay. And if we don't see an improvement within a week and somebody's still having symptoms, even if they aren't losing weight, even if they're not throwing up all day, but they just have persistent symptoms, then we should be moving on. The main question that, you know, that I've seen from people, and I think that this is the one that came up a lot in the broadcast channel, is Zofran or Ondansetron.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
So the thing that really frustrates me about this medication is how many doctor's offices are saying, well, we don't prescribe this anymore until after 10 weeks. And this is another symptom of our very broken healthcare system, because I think a lot of doctors and doctor's offices are so overwhelmed with how many patients they have to see, how much work they have, that they don't have enough time to actually look at the data and actually look at the research. If you actually look at the data and look at the research, Zofran is not a medication that we should be overly concerned with when it comes to congenital anomalies, also known as birth defects, okay? First of all, the vast majority of the data shows no difference in the baseline rate of congenital anomalies for people who are taking Zofran. That's the vast majority of data. Of the studies that showed an increased risk, we see there's a few of them. And you know what we see? We see a less than 1% risk increase for cleft palate and heart defects, less than 1%. The overall risk of your baby having a congenital anomaly is about 2-3%. That's baseline. Everybody, no matter what, you take nothing, you do everything perfectly, you still have a 2-3% risk of a baby with a congenital anomaly. Some of those are no big deal. It's like a, you know, a small, like supernumerary digit, like a small extra finger, etc. And some of them are more complex, you know, complex heart issues, incompatible with life, stuff like that. So we're talking about a less than 1% increase, possible increased risk, with most of the data showing nothing. So tell me why this medication, which is one of the most effective medications that we have for hyperemesis, that we have for nausea and vomiting in pregnancy, why this has been so vilified. It's out there in the world that this may increase the risk of, or that it does increase the risk of birth defects. And one, I think there's a lot of physicians who do not have enough time to update their knowledge and do their own research, and are just kind of, they too are susceptible to the headlines and to the stories because they're not going into the primary sources. And two, there's just like, okay, patients are worried about it. Patients are questioning them. The explanation takes time. Reassuring patients that it's actually from a congenital anomaly standpoint is not something that should be, yes, talk to people about this less than 1% potential increased risk. Talk to people about it. So a lot of things are just like, oh no, we just don't prescribe it in pregnancy. We don't prescribe it after 10 weeks.
But one of the things,
so fired up.
And I'm about to get you even more fired up, because what that whole conversation, when you're talking to a provider about the risks of medication, is completely leaving out is the risks of not treating your 100%. Nausea and vomiting and suffering, it causing increased stress, anxiety, depression, sleepless nights, loss of nutrition. And aren't there more risks associated with all of that than with Zofran for a few weeks?
I think that that's a really important point. And you can't say like a blanket statement that the benefits of Zofran always outweigh the risks.
Right.
Because there are other risks to Zofran. One of the risks of Zofran is for people who have an abnormality in the way that the electrical conductivity of their heart, something called a prolonged QT syndrome. And sometimes that's asymptomatic. Zofran can impact that too. So some people, if you have any heart issues in your family, or you have had, anybody's ever told you that you have abnormal EKG, or you should have an EKG before you start it. Some people say that, you know, anybody who started on Zofran should have an EKG first. Most people don't say that. They just say that, you know, if you have any risk factors. So it's something to talk to your doctor about. So there's that. And then, of course, Zofran has side effects. Some of the side effects are really tough. The constipation that comes with Zofran can be really tough. It can cause headaches. So if you're already having headaches, you know, so it's not a perfect drug. A lot of the drugs that we kind of come before Zofran in the algorithm have a lot of side effects. A lot of them are very sedating. You know, one of the medications that's very commonly prescribed, oftentimes before we get ondansetron or Zofran, is a medication called Reglan. I took Reglan in my pregnancy, and it has the risk factor, especially for people who have a history of depression, of triggering a depressive episode. And I think the Reglan that I took was part of me developing that episode of depression. So, you know, for somebody who is already like, if you're on an SSRI, you have a history of severe depression, starting Reglan instead of ondansetron just doesn't make sense, right? But what that is to say is I took Zofran in all three of my pregnancies. And again, I was not vomiting. I was not losing weight. I was not able to function without it. We know that our mental health impacts our pregnancy outcomes. We know that it impacts fetal development. And I think that not feeling suicidal is a really important thing for individuals in pregnancy and outside of pregnancy. So yes, I think it's underprescribed because people have heard that Zofran is associated with congenital anomalies and birth defects. Anybody who has taken Zofran and then their baby had a congenital anomaly, which 2-3% of people are going to have that, all attributing it to the Zofran. People are all over my posts, and I don't necessarily blame them. The problem is we're not doing proper health education in the doctor's office because we don't have time, which is obviously why I'm here.
People are listening back to this episode, and obviously we've talked a lot about HG and hyperemesis and severe, severe nausea and vomiting. And I was in that group of my first pregnancy, I had some nausea.
Yeah.
My second, I had a lot more debilitating nausea and some vomiting. And I was walking that line of, it could be so much worse. Mm. Do I really need to take this? And we often do that with pregnancy loss, is comparing how much worse it could have been and someone else's experience. And I was definitely doing that to myself of like, do I really need this relief? To go as far as to say, do I deserve this when like it's really made for the people who really, really need it?
Yeah.
Where do you find that line of it is worth you addressing your nausea if it does XYZ to your quality of life? What's your usual Sterling parents rec?
Listen, I think if it's impacting the quality of your life, then you should be moving down the algorithm. You start with a lifestyle changes, start with vitamin B6, symptoms, it's still impacting your quality of life. It's still impacting your ability to function. When it comes to nausea, vomiting, and pregnancy, my job as a clinician, as a physician, is to relieve pain and suffering. And this is a huge source of pain and suffering. We have medications that can help. They're not perfect, but I consider them safe. Like, I consider these medications safe. They are not risk-free, but I consider them safe. So I think that everybody whose quality of life is being impacted to these symptoms should be moving down the algorithm. And if there's more suffering and more anxiety and more fear from the treatment than there is from just having the symptoms, well, then it's not right for you. I think that we are in general not kind enough to ourselves. So my golden rule of pregnancy is be gentle to yourself. Be gentle to yourself, be kind to yourself. And if you ask yourself, what's the kindest approach that I could take? Is that taking the medication? Is that what would be kind to me? We have to acknowledge that our health and our wellness is not just about our numbers. It's not just about our weight. It's not just about the fact that we are alive and our heart is beating. It's about everything. So I really want you to look at yourself as a whole person. We know that social isolation is not good for people in pregnancy. We saw that with the pandemic. So the social isolation, the depression, all of the symptoms that kind of stem from the nausea and vomiting, I think we need to be taking a hard look at treatment for anybody whose quality of life is being impacted.
And then the other layer that kept coming up in the chat with questions is nutrition.
Yeah.
Because it oftentimes prevents you. I mean, it prevented both of us in our pregnancies from drinking water.
Yeah.
So it can prevent some things that are recommended for people when they're pregnant. So where do you start with people's concerns of the only thing that's getting me through is soda and Doritos? Yeah. Is baby going to be okay?
Yeah.
To the people who are in the middle saying like, it's preventing me. What can I do to get better nutrition?
Yeah. Where do they start? So first of all, in the first trimester, people lose weight in the first trimester. People or don't gain weight or have a very hard time getting proper nutrition. If you are in the category where you're losing weight or you're not gaining weight, we really want to be taking a look at you, because what we really want to prevent is that's continuing to the second trimester. Because once we're seeing weight loss, continuing to see no weight gain in the second trimester, then we start getting concerned about the impact on fetal development. Now, I should say this is mostly a concern for people underweight, normal weight, and in the overweight category. So between a BMI of 25 and 29. Now, I've talked about this before on this podcast. I don't love BMI as a tool. There's a lot of problems with it, but that's what the data is based on. So if you have a BMI of 30 or higher, and as you go up in BMI, we don't see the same risks with not gaining weight and with losing weight. That is to say, that's a double-edged sword, you know? It can make it so that people who are in larger bodies and are really suffering with nausea and vomiting in pregnancy, it can mean that your care providers are less likely to be as aggressive, because some weight loss or not gaining weight may actually improve pregnancy outcomes. That's what you made that face, and I wish that wasn't what we saw in the data. I really do, because I almost don't want to tell people that.
Yeah.
It's like, oh yeah, if your BMI is 30 and up, if you're losing weight in pregnancy, which tends to mean you're really not doing well, that you may actually improve your pregnancy outcomes, and we don't see the same risk to baby. So I want to be factually accurate, even though I don't think it's okay to just let people have severe nausea and vomiting.
Yeah, you got to consider the pain and suffering that comes with that. Compared to technically, it bumps you into a different category.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that someone can take it as a little reassurance if they happen to be in that category. Well, at least I don't have to worry about this harming baby. So that's the way I would take it if I were you. But I don't think that that means that we shouldn't be treating it, which is sometimes that's one of the issues. And we actually need to do a podcast on pregnancy when you're in a larger body. Elevated BMI. We need to do an episode of that for sure. But anyway, so going back to what I was saying before, we want to control that weight loss. So that it's not continuing to the second trimester, because we do see that people who have continued weight loss in the second trimester who aren't gaining weight, we do see even some long-term health sequelae for the fetus. So we want to be proactive about it. The first trimester, very common. First trimester weight loss and not gaining weight, we don't worry about. We don't see the same impact on fetus. We need to be very proactive when we see that. But if you just have that problem in the first trimester, okay, you're okay. We just need to get control over it. The first level is getting the calories in and getting the hydration in. A lot of people in the first trimester with severe nausea, vomiting, that's all we can worry about at the beginning. We don't care where the calories are coming from. You need calories and you need hydration, okay? So that's the first level. And then we move up to, okay, typically we can tolerate some carbohydrates. That's the easiest thing for people to tolerate. Can we add a little bit of fat? Can we add a little bit of protein? So trying to add fat and protein where we can. For members of Sterling Parents, we have a really wonderful class and discussion with Crystal Cargas, who's a nutritionist and a mom of five. And she talks about pyramid of how we move through and what we worry about at our different Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Like you first, you just got to take care of calories and hydration. And then you can move on to like, okay, well, what about our macro protein, carbohydrate, and fat?
Oftentimes we say, all right, my eating in pregnancy isn't the best. I'm taking a prenatal vitamin that encompasses a lot of the nutrients we need. What are the recommendations when taking a prenatal is really, really difficult to do as a part of, you're supposed to wake up in the morning, you feel so nauseous, you can 100%. Barely do anything. Here's a horse pill to put in your mouth.
Yeah.
Okay. Where do you start there?
First things first, first 10 weeks of pregnancy when trying to conceive, that's the time where it's most critical for preventing, like folic acid for preventing neural tube defects and congenital anomalies. So that's the first 10 weeks, which is also when, when it tends to be its worst, that's the most critical time. I will tell you, I didn't have a single pregnancy in which I was able to take a prenatal vitamin every day. So one of the things that we do in the first trimester when somebody has nausea and vomiting is we oftentimes will move to just folic acid. We can also try gummy prenatals. Gummy prenatals are always lack iron. You can't put iron, at least not at this time, you can't put iron into a gummy. It's just not compatible with a gummy. So it doesn't have iron, but for most people, you know, unless you're anemic before pregnancy, most people don't really need iron in the first trimester. It becomes more critical in the second trimester. So we move people to folic acid supplementation alone or a gummy vitamin and just know that we're not getting that iron. Now, there's also a prescription that's available in the United States for a prenatal vitamin called VitaPearl. It's a really small prenatal vitamin. So that's one of the things that I used when I was pregnant. I love that prenatal, but it is a prescription. And I don't know if it's available in other countries. As far as I've looked, it's only available here. You do your best to take it as many days as you can and know that a day is unlikely to make a significant impact, and you do your best. If your provider is showing like a complete lack of empathy and you are saying that you're telling them, I am suffering and I need help. If you have said the words, I am suffering and I need help, and you don't get that help, typically this is earlier in your pregnancy and you should really think about looking into finding another provider. Okay. Because this to me is a big red flag. OBGYN who's not willing to adequately support and treat nausea, vomiting, and pregnancy, I think is a red flag for things to come. Now, don't go firing them right away without making sure that you've got another place to go, because a doctor is better than no doctor in almost all circumstances. Telling them how you feel, even if you're not losing weight. See, and they're saying, well, you're not losing weight, so we typically don't prescribe medications for people who aren't losing weight. You say, I am suffering. My quality of life is in the toilet. I need help. That's it. And I'm telling you, if your physician or midwife or nurse practitioner, whoever you're seeing, if they don't then say, okay, all right, let's
here's what we're gonna
pull
do.
Pull out your ACOG algorithm. Let's move down the algorithm. Let's do it. Then this is, you need to find another provider within the practice tell them, listen, if you're not willing to adequately treat my nausea and vomiting pregnancy, like, I can't stay here. I need treatment.
I think that's a perfect place to end. And obviously, we could do hours on this. There's so many aspects. We even in the membership in Sterling Parents have an hour on the types of medications. And it really is just answering and breaking down the algorithm. So, yeah. So many different things we could touch on, but this is a great place to start.
All of the stuff about Zofran, the risks and benefits, and all of the risks and benefits of the other medications that are on the algorithm. Because again, a lot of providers do not have the time to sit down and go through the risks and benefits of, yeah, and the side effects that you can expect with all of these different medications. And I will say, if you are someone who has had bad nausea and vomiting before, you've had hyperemesis before, and you're considering having another one, please consider joining Sterling Parents as you prepare for that so that we can help support you, because you do not have to do this alone. Right now we have a wait list, but we're taking people off the wait list here and there as spots open up. So please go to sterlingparents.com, join the wait list. When you're listening to this, we might even be open and have spots available. So please do not feel like you have to do this alone. And if you're pregnant right now, you're not alone. We're here for you. Thanks for listening to Ask Dr. Sterling. Is there someone in your life who would benefit from listening to this episode? Send it to them. If you've left a review in Apple Podcasts or Spotify, thank you so much. Please send me a DM at Ask Dr. Sterling Podcast on Instagram with a screenshot so I can say thank you personally.